Reading our prayers. Well, it's good to be here this morning again with all of you. Some of you might recognize this person here. You don't have to shout out crazy guesses. Anyone? Raise your hand if you think you know who that is. Anyone? It's maybe a little obscure. But you'll probably recognize his name. Back in 1957, Fortune magazine named J. Paul Getty, the richest living American. Anyone heard of him? Yes. And in 1966, Guinness Book of Records named him as the world's richest private citizen. Getty owned the controlling interest in about 200 businesses. And including, of course, Getty Oil. And at his death, he was worth more than $6 billion, which today is about $21 or $22 billion. So he had a lot of money. As one of the richest men who ever lived, though, you would expect him not to be envious of anyone. He could buy basically whatever he wanted, but he was envious. He once admitted that he was envious of those who knew how to make marriage work and find happiness in marriage. For despite all his wealth, he never had a happy marriage. He was married and divorced 5 times. From its institution in Genesis 2 through the pages of the New Testament, God has a lot to say about marriage. And it's in the scriptures that we find how marriage is supposed to work. And when his instructions are followed, marriage can indeed be truly wonderful. Now, I realize that when we come to this subject of marriage, there's great diversity represented in this room today. There's many single people. Some are thinking about marriage. Others have no interest in it. There are many who have been married in the past. Some of those marriages were happy marriages. Others maybe were not so happy. There are married couples here who are not so happy in their current marriage. The joy has kind of seeped out of it. And they find themselves living together but not really in joy or not much happiness in that marriage. Couples married a long time. Others are married a relatively short time. Some individuals here are open to God's instructions about marriage, while others are resistant to what he says about the subject. So I say that to just acknowledge that in this group today, there's people from all perspectives about this. Some of you will interpret what I say through looking back over a past marriage, maybe over a failed marriage, or from the context of a happy marriage, or even from the setting of looking forward one day to getting married. In 1 Peter 2, in 1 Peter 3, rather, Peter is going to bring on instructions for wives and husbands, and 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7. That's on page 1015 in the Pew Bibles, and I would encourage you to find these words because you probably aren't going to believe it if I just tell you. Okay, now, we have seen over the last few weeks Peter giving guidance to believers in regard to various relationships. 2 weeks ago, we talked about a Christian's relationship to civil authorities. And then last week we heard about the role of Christians who are servants, how they are to relate to their masters. But now in chapter 3 we come to the subject of wives and husbands. And there's always a lot of interest in this and probably a good measure of disagreement on how things should be understood, but that's okay. After hearing this, you'll know the truth and everything will be clear to you. I'm kidding. But so let's, if you found that, I hope you have, let's read these wonderful words. 1 Peter chapter 3. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. When they see your respectful and pure conduct, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold, the jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So, there's nothing controversial here. Now, Peter has 6 verses of instructions for wives and just 1 verse for husbands. So I thought if I play this right, we'll only have time to get through 6 verses. But my wife told me, you get to verse 7. Peter's emphasis, I would say, and the reason I think he spends more time speaking to the woman, to the wife, seems to be on helping those who are most vulnerable to ill treatment. And this, I think, is a pattern we can see in regard to civil authorities. It's not the Christians who are going to treat the civil authorities bad. It's the civil authorities who might treat Christians bad. Regarding masters and servants, it's not the servants who are going to treat their masters bad. It's the masters who could inflict poor treatment upon their servants. And here, Peter mentions unbelieving or uninformed Christian husbands about their treatment of their wives. So I think that's why, following his pattern, he speaks more gives more instructions for wives. But basically, Peter has 2 directives here. The first one is in verse 1. He starts right off with this. He says, be subject to your husbands. Now, we have been hearing Peter call Christians to be subject to different groups. In verse 2:13 and 2:18, be subject to the governing authorities, be subject to the masters, you who are servants. And now, once again, but Christians are, generally speaking, submissive people. And I want to just put these verses up here and just so you realize this, we are called to submit ourselves to God. We are called to submit to God's law, to submit to the governing authorities, to submit to the church leaders. And in Ephesians 5, Paul says that the church as a whole submits to Jesus our Lord. And so we are, in a sense, submissive people. Now, that's not a bad thing. It doesn't make us any worse for submitting. Now, in the world's eyes, it may be interpreted that way, but certainly not by the Christian who knows that Jesus, too, was submissive. He submitted to his Father's will. And he even submitted to the ill treatment of wicked people. He submitted his life and went to the cross and set for us a pattern of this kind of submission and yielding under the will of God. So we should not be shocked or troubled when the Lord calls wives to willingly submit to their husband's authority or leadership in the marriage. And this is what he's doing. Not only here in this context, But in other places in the New Testament, this is the consistent teaching. In these verses we see, wives, submit to your husbands as fitting in the Lord. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And in Titus 2:4, the older women can train the younger women to love their husbands and children and to be submissive to their own husbands. And I know there is debate about the extent of this. I'm going to mention that in a moment. But this does seem to be the general teaching of Scripture. Now, to be sure, there have been husbands and even Christian leaders who have taken a position that their wives are to submit to them no matter what. That it is an unqualified command. And not so much today, but I'd say 20, 30, 40 years ago, there was more of this kind of teaching going around. It seems to have kind of faded, and that's, I think, a good thing. But I know personally of husbands who have latched onto this verse to justify mean and abusive behavior. But husbands are nowhere told to enforce their wife's submission. They're not told that you have to, you are enforcers. But some men in the past, even in the recent past in America, have justified this through the interpretation and have used it as a means to lord it over their wives and to basically command them just to do whatever they wanted and have been mean and abusive, pointing this verse out to them. And there are stories about this. I thought of sharing some, or at least one, but I just really don't have time this morning. But there was an interesting case in Minnesota where a woman was acquitted from shooting her husband not that long ago. It was in the Twin Cities. And in her testimony, she talked about how her husband grabbed hold of this verse. Her husband was a pastor. And he controlled her and abused her and beat her. And he justified it because she was to submit no matter what. And one morning she got up after he had threatened to kill her. Got the gun that he kept in the bedroom and killed him. But the jury acquitted her. Now, I'm not saying you should do that, please. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that, again, this verse has been abused, okay? Furthermore, there are limits, I believe, to a wife's submission. Now, some, as I said, disagree with that. But I believe there are, just as there are limits to obeying the civil authorities. We obey them to the extent, is obvious from Acts, I think 5, to the extent that what they tell us to do does not conflict with God's law. Peter makes that clear. You judge whether it's right to obey you or God. But I think, and I want to just state these, and I invite, and I'm not going to go into them because I don't have time, but what I would do is invite you to discuss this further in your small groups. Some of the small groups at least, maybe all, are using questions from the sermon, and you can discuss this in your small group, and maybe you'll come to a different conclusion. But I think there are at least these five areas where when submission is inappropriate. First of all, when it would violate biblical teaching, when we're told to do something that the Bible outright says you should not do or violates a clear biblical principle. Also, when it would compromise the care and protection of her children. I read a story about a man who told his wife not to buckle the kids in the seatbelt. He didn't want them in seatbelts. I know it sounds really bizarre. But believe me, there's a lot of crazy people out there. And the guy had to stop fast, and one of the kids went flying into the front seat from the back. And he uses that as an example that we are not to, a wife is not called to submit if it's going to jeopardize the welfare of her children. Third, when it would enable her husband to sin. So, guys, you can't say to your wife, now, I'm going to run in the bank here, and I want you to keep the car running. It's not me, it's not you, but I'm commanding you, and you have to submit to this. No, you're helping your husband to sin if he's going in to rob the bank. Okay, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You could, but you shouldn't. Also, when it involves physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, because that would be accommodating sin, sins of your husband. And I would add also when it would violate your own conscience, wives should not submit. Because as a wife, your first and highest commitment is to God. Submit to your husbands, but God is still God, and He comes first. And that's part of what I think we'll see here. Peter is aware of this. They are to submit to their wives, but Peter recognizes that in some cases where they do not have believing husbands, it could especially be bad. And even some believing husbands are bad in the way they treat their wives. So I believe this is, in these areas, it is inappropriate to submit. There may be more. You may disagree, and that's okay. But I think they can be borne out from a close examination of Scripture. Peter reminds his wives to be subject here to their husbands for a specific reason at the end of verse 1 and 2. There may be some wives who have these unbelieving husbands. And Peter mentions this where I don't think Paul in his writings really about marriage gets to this situation where there's a Christian woman married to an unbelieving or a sometimes disobedient. He's not obeying the gospel, not following Jesus. And this creates a real problem in that setting. And that's why, as we get to the end here in just a few minutes, it's really, really important you are careful about who you marry. Now, marriage is always a risk because people can change. But you have to be careful about who you marry. We'll get to that at the end in just a couple minutes here. But and Peter's advice to those women in that case is that a willing cooperative submission will help win them to the Lord. And this would be the best for everyone. And he says not by words. Now, some people think he's talking about being nagging. I don't know. He doesn't say that. They may be won without a word. Now, at some point, you have to share the gospel with the person, but his focus and his emphasis is on their godly behavior, behaving in a way that is attractive to them and pleasing to them, which is consistent with the will of God, okay? And it is by their respectful and pure conduct. It's interesting, and I think important to remember that in the first century, Roman society, women were expected to follow the religion of their husbands. That was what society did. The family religion was that of the husband. But Peter supports the women in following Christ and encourages them in trying to win their husbands to Christ as well. And the way to do it, Peter says, is to be a good wife. As best as you can, he would say, and I believe he would add, without compromising your Christian, your obedience to Jesus and following God's teachings, without compromising that. And for some women married to an unbeliever, that becomes very difficult, very difficult. There could be a price to be paid for that. And that's what I think he hints at down at the very end, the very last words of verse 6, this idea of fear, fearing anything that's frightening. So this is what his instruction is. It's in line with other New Testament teaching. I think it's God's pattern, but I think it's qualified by certain things, just like our obedience to the civic authorities are. Now, directly related to Peter's exhortation for wives to be subject to their husbands is his call in verses 3 and 4 to pursue imperishable beauty. And here he talks about women and what they wear and how they dress. Now, I know this could get into some difficult things here, but let me say, Peter is, he's not prohibiting these things because he talks about putting on clothes. He's not prohibiting clothing, okay? He's not doing that. So he's not prohibiting these things. But what he is doing, he is clearly discouraging a focus on outer beauty and as opposed to inner beauty. Now, some people think he has overly expensive or immodest clothing in mind. And there is evidence from the first century that excessive jewelry, elaborate braiding, and costly clothing was common in the upper class Roman culture. Just like it is, I mean, just it's not dissimilar. It hasn't really changed. And what basically he is saying is that, look, you may be tempted to pursue this kind of beauty. And no woman wants to make herself look bad. Everyone's trying to look as good as they can. I mean, even I try, you know, and I don't have much to work with. So we all try that, but Peter knows that what really matters is the inner person, the hidden person of the heart. While it is not visible itself, it is seen in words and actions which reflect inward attitudes. And this is what the Lord counts as valuable. See that? He counts that as valuable. Very precious in God's sight, the end of verse 4. And that's why some people think he's saying, using this word of expense or value in contrast to expensive clothing. This is what's really valuable. Not the high price clothes and such and jewelry and all that. To God, what's really valuable are these characteristics of a gentle and quiet spirit. This is what God prizes. And this is what Peter is telling these women. The gentle person does not insist on one's own rights or way. They do not attack back. You pretty much know what gentleness is. Jesus referred to himself as gentle. And the Spirit, according to the fruit of this passage on the fruit of the Spirit, leads all Christians to have gentleness, to manifest gentleness towards in our dealings with other people. So gentleness is not merely a trait for women. It's for all Christians, and Jesus himself possessed it. But here he mentions it for these wives who find, probably addressing all wives, but especially those who may be in this situation of having an unbelieving husband. You may win them without a word by having this inner beauty, this thing that is so attractive and all people appreciate and are drawn to. So a gentle spirit and a quiet spirit, as opposed to a restless and rebellious heart. This quietness reflects a trust, a confidence in God. They can be at peace even when there's difficulties, even when there's trouble. That's the idea behind this quietness. Not that they're just a quiet person. You may be a quiet person, but it's the calmness of your heart. Why is it calm? Because Jesus is there and you trust in God. And this idea of hoping or trusting in God is what he's going to come to next. So Peter ends his words to these Christian wives by giving them an example to follow. And now it's going to go even up a higher step. Peter's going to say, look to the example of the holy women. And in particular, there's this one woman in the Bible. Her name's Sarah, the wife of Abraham. And this is what he's talking about in verses 5 and 6. He gives them this example. Those women who hoped in God adorn themselves in these ways, the ones he's talked about. But he is also looking forward and goes back to what he said at the very beginning of the verse, the chapter in verse 1. They adorn themselves, how? By submitting to their husbands. That's exactly what the text says. So even in the Old Testament, wives were submitting to their husbands, and this is seen as a good thing, a pleasing thing to God. Their hope in God is expressed in their willing cooperation and honoring of their husbands instead of resisting and going against them, fighting with them, saying things, doing things behind their back, this kind of thing. And if you're married, you know what I'm talking about here. And Peter's point is that Sarah obeyed Abraham and goes all the way and has to say this. And even called Abraham Lord. Now, it is only recorded one time. But she still did it. And she did call him Lord when he was very old. Because that's what she says. My Lord is old. Wives still say that today. Maybe not use the word Lord. Well, my husband's old. Yeah. But for Peter, this is a positive thing that Sarah did. And his point is that she was respectful to her husband. Now, I'm not saying this is you have to go around calling your husbands Lord, because you're not going to do that. And I don't think God is calling us to do that, but he is calling wives to be respectful and to submit to their husbands. I think that's the clear teaching of Scripture. Whether they are Christians or not. It's harder when they are not Christians. It's much harder. But all Christian wives are to follow this pattern. And then at the end here where he says, you are her children if you do good, and do not fear anything that is frightening. And this is where I think this idea of fear, and it's such an odd phrase, do not fear anything that is frightening. He's probably talking about the fear that a wife might have when she's married to an unbeliever who calls her to do that which she knows she cannot do. To sin, to participate in idols, to participate in the sacrifice or the burning incense to the emperor. Christians weren't to do that. To them it was idolatry, of course, and so they couldn't. And so the woman who is married to an unbeliever then was in a difficult spot. But Peter says, don't be afraid. God is with you, he's saying, and be like Sarah, and don't fear these things. God will help you through it. Now, there are women today who are married to unbelieving husbands, and it is difficult. Sometimes they don't want you to go to church. Sometimes they try to get you to sin. Sometimes they try to get you to come out and do things that go against your conscience. And Peter is sympathetic with that, and so am I. It's a very difficult kind of place to be. I'm going to talk about that in just a moment, but first we must get to verse 7. So Peter has instructions for Christian men. We've been waiting for this, but he compresses it all into a single verse. And there he also has two directives. One, live with your wife in an understanding way. An understanding way. Then thinking, what does that mean? I don't understand what it means to live in an understanding way. Well, it could mean to live together with the knowledge of God's will. Some people think understanding God's will. But I think Peter intends a broader sense here. It likely includes that, but also extends to any knowledge that would be beneficial to the husband-wife relationship. This would include knowledge of his wife's strengths and weaknesses, her desires and needs, as well as the greater emotional sensitivity that women typically possess, maybe not all, but generally. So in addition to being charged to love your wives, as Christ loved the church in Ephesians 5 and prohibited from being harsh with them in Colossians 3:19, Christian husbands are also told to know how to be good husbands. Learn it if you don't know it. Understand it. And of course, there's great, all kinds of great resources out available today to Christian men, husbands, to learn. There's books, there's seminars, there's conferences that focus on this issue. Because the problem men have is that they think like men. And they look at their wife and they think, well, what does she want? And they think in terms of what a man wants. And that's not what your wife wants. It's totally different. And so her needs are different from your needs as men, Christian husbands. And so I believe he's telling men to wise up, be smart, know about this. And so he charges them to understand your wife. And secondly, they are to honor our wives. Show honor to your wives. Same word, it means honor or respect your wives. They are to not speak badly or treat them poorly, but honor them in word and deed. Now back in chapter 2, verse 17, Peter told his readers to honor the king. It is appropriate for who he is, so show him honor. But now he tells us to honor our wives. Because even though, generally speaking, they have less physical strength than their husbands, they too have experienced God's grace and are counted among the children of God. Honor is appropriate for who she is. She's a child of the king, and you better treat her as such. Just because you are bigger and stronger doesn't mean that you should be harsh or rough or intimidating or in any way physically abusive. No, you have to treat her. You have to treat her for who she is. She's a fellow Christian, but she's a daughter of the king of kings. And he doesn't like it when his children are not treated right. And so Peter ends this by saying, you better do this so that your prayers aren't hindered. Why would our prayers be hindered? Well, if we're not following the guidance, husbands, that we are to give, to follow here, God's not going to hear our prayers. It's just like what it says in Psalms. David said, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear my prayer. Well, this is pretty much the same thing. If I treat my wife badly, the Lord's not going to hear my prayer because I'm sinning. I'm sinning. And so I have to be careful to do this. And sadly, this temptation to treat wives poorly continues today across in our world. We see it in our society all the time. Spousal abuse, you know. Certainly that has no place in regard to a Christian husband. Actually, it is just the opposite. It is honoring and cherishing and caring for and loving and providing for and showing respect for. So that's what we are called to do. And that's a lot. That's a lot. And sometimes we fail. Sometimes we fail. We always have this selfish tendency always back towards ourselves. But in a marriage, you have to overcome that as a Christian and honor your wife. Now, in a moment, we're going to come to the Lord's table, but I want to just take this opportunity to speak this word to those who may one day be getting married. And you already know what I'm going to say, and it's something I've said many times. If you are a follower of Jesus, make sure you marry a follower of Jesus. It's not enough that they say they go to church or they believe in God. Marry a person who is also following Jesus. Okay? This is what Paul tells us in these verses, 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? The answer is none. Where else are you more closely yoked to a person in this life than in marriage? Marriage, every day, together. So don't do that. It won't work. While it will be hard. You may survive it, but it's going to be difficult. And secondly, what he points out in 1 Corinthians 7, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whomever she wishes. But what? Only in the Lord. Only another Christian. Paul restricts that. He's guiding them to marry in the faith. Do people follow that advice? Sometimes no. Do they regret it? Oftentimes yes. Sometimes they think, well, I'll change this person. Yeah, well, good luck with that. That might happen, but rather instead as you might find yourself going in a completely opposite direction. They don't want to go to church, so pretty soon you're not going to church. They don't want to read the scriptures, so pretty soon you're not reading the scriptures. They don't care what God thinks, so pretty soon you don't care what God thinks. And so I'm encouraging to avoid that. So, that wasn't long ago I had this. We were talking about some of the minor prophets. Why you should marry a believer. One, and there's a longer than four, but I'm out of time. They will love you and care for you according to the Lord's teaching because they're committed to the Lord. And they will follow the Lord, and they will treat you as the Lord tells them to treat you, which is very well. They will delight in your spiritual growth and obedience and following the Lord. You will have encouragement from them to serve the Lord and live to please Him. And your children will grow up with consistent examples of faith and godliness. Now, if you marry a person who doesn't follow Jesus, these are all the opposites of those. And you're walking into it. But know that's what you're going to have going forward. So, again, if you're a follower of Jesus, marry a follower of Jesus, and you can have a wonderful marriage, an absolutely wonderful marriage. In Ephesians